it went from the highest point in my life where I'd never had something happen to the absolute lowest where he didn't come back from. I found the way through the sump. He did the next dive. He was a much better dry caver. So he went and, you know, to make a long story short, it was then all of a sudden the realities of exploration just hit me in the face when your friend doesn't come back. He left with a teddy bear on his helmet, you know, one of his two young kids. And you realize you're at the bottom of the earth the next 6 days spending with your friend's, you know, dead body, bringing it up to the surface. You're never the same after that.
G'day, I'm Richard Harris, and thanks for joining me on Real Risk, the adventure podcast. G'day, welcome back once again. I've got a great show for you today with a couple of fascinating guests, brought to you, as always, by Bremont, makers of superb and high-quality timepieces from the United Kingdom. I have tried to promise myself that I won't talk to cavers and cave divers every single episode. Of course, that's my main interest and something I'd like to do, but I've been very restrained. And today, I couldn't stop myself because I was very fortunate to catch two of my very close friends and most respected cave divers, both at the same place in the Bahamas, Brian K. Cook, the owner and manager of Bahamas Underground and the custodian of some of the most spectacular and scientifically most important caves in the world on the island of Abaco in the Bahamas. And joining him, staying with him on Abaco, is his good friend and scientist, Dr. Kenny Broad, who's an exceptional character, one who when you're around him, you can't help but smile and enjoy his company. And together they're doing some important mapping and surveying of the caves on that island. And so without further ado, it's a great pleasure to welcome Brian K. Cook and Kenny Broad. Well, I'm very excited to be talking to two close friends of mine, two great diving buddies, and two guys who I don't like to say it in front of them, but I do rather admire them, if not for their skill, at least for the amount of time they spend underwater, especially Mr. Brian K. Cook. Brian, thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks for the invite. Really appreciate it. Good to see you, Harry.
I can't imagine there are many people in this world who spend more time with their head underwater in a cave than you yourself. there are many cave divers around the world who are jealous of that.
That's we're fortunate to have some really great stuff right down the road.
And second, but larger than life, I should say, Dr. Kenny Broad, who is a close friend of Brian's and a part-time resident of the Bahamas because he has a beautiful little oceanfront house in Little Harbour, Abaco. Kenny, great to see you this morning.
Hey, good morning here.
Now, Kenny, what is an environmental anthropologist and what on earth has it got to do with cave diving?
So an environmental anthropologist, to put it simply, is a made-up title that allows you to get involved with as many different projects as possible. I guess in the sense that you can combine both environmental, physical, and natural science projects, but along with understanding the human side of it, the human behavior side of how we treat the environment, right? We don't manage water. We manage the people who control the water, who use the water. We don't manage fish. We manage the fishing groups. So we learn about human behavior, but also understanding how that interacts and the feedbacks between the natural system and what I would call the craziest species on Earth, the humans.
And you live in Miami?
Yeah, so Miami is my ancestral village. So, right. Which is, you know, a great place to be from, and it's a great base for getting to all different parts of the world. And as Brian figured out, it's pretty close to some of the most amazing, diverse caves in the world here in the Bahamas, but also the Floridan Aquifer. North is you know, for the U.S., really, I would say, ground zero for the cave diving community.
Was Florida the birthplace for cave diving for you? Is that where it started for you?
Yeah, definitely. And it was just by first getting into free diving, and then I guess the attraction when I started teaching diving, it was with an old time cave diver, Bob Friedman, who, you know, back when, you know, he made us use Clorox bottles, instead of BC's to show how it used to go. And he introduced me to Wes Giles and to Sheck Exley. And then I ended up learning from Wes and his gang of non-traditional divers, if I can put it that way.
Were you part of that group called the Moles?
Well, they were all older than me, so I was the young tag-along. I know this is radio, but I actually had hair down to my shoulders, which now I have one big solar panel. And, I mean, ironically, when Wes, I was coming to the Bahamas quite a bit for different marine-related work when I was younger. But, you know, what's interesting is Brian and I didn't know each other, and Brian was working with the Navy with AUTEC in Andros Island, doing some crazy exploration essentially by himself or with Brad Purcell. And we had always heard about each other. And then it wasn't until we worked on a Hollywood film together that we finally got to meet. And it was really great. And that's, like you said, Brian, there's no one who spends more time underwater than Brian. And a lot of cave divers are jealous. I'm one of those jealous cave divers. And I don't want to, see, this is radio, so you can't see Brian blushing, but I can't thank him enough for kind of bringing me back into cave diving after having some, to be honest, sort of horrific experiences.
Yeah. Do not blame that on me.
So if anything goes wrong and anything broken in a cave, it's Brian's fault.
Amy, he's lying.
Yeah. Brian, what was your first impression of Kenny when you met him?
Well, we met, like Kenny said, we had known about each other, and I actually met his wife, Amy, at a talk that I gave at University of Miami. And she's like, you guys have been missing each other. We've all been on different expeditions with the same people, but not at the same time. And then we both got hired to do dive safety on a film called Into the Blue in Nassau. And we have a mutual friend who was the Marine coordinator for that, Dan Malone. That's one of Kenny's childhood friends. And I had dived with Dan on the Ocean Explorer, showing them caves in Andros. And so, yeah, that was our first time. But then you ended up having to leave early or something like that, right?
Yeah, my day job at the university kicked in, and So I was only able to spend a couple months on the job.
So that's the difference between Kenny and I. He's a grown-up and actually has a life, whereas I'm a dive bum.
I was going to point that out, that you seem to have managed to make this your day job, and obviously maybe business is suffering a bit with the virus, Brian, but you have made a life out of this passion for underwater caves. Do you want to tell us how that journey came about?
I think in the late 80s, early 90s, there really wasn't any such thing as a professional cave diver that I was aware of. I mean, Wes was probably one of the closest. Even people like Sheck Exley, he was actually a teacher, so that was his passion, but it was his side gig. And so, and as it was for myself as well for a long time, and then eventually, I guess I just got frustrated with the inability to do it as much as I needed to and really immerse myself in it. And then I decided that I wanted to try to do it full time. And it's not a viable business. I mean, it's a business of passion. You're not gonna build up your 401k with being a professional cave diver. Just not there, especially in the Bahamas where overhead is so ridiculous. So it's a job of passion, and it's something that I want to do until the day the doctor says I can't.
Well, I think it's a lyric from a Sean Mullins song that says, "Ain't it a blessing to do what you want?"
Oh yeah,
and I think I hope you don't mind me saying this, from the old school of cave diving. You sort of taught yourself in a way, didn't you? And then had a few near misses, and went back and checked the books and saw what you might have done wrong, and then came back and sorted it out. What was that process like? Can you describe the early days of cave diving for you, Brian?
Well, so I mean, a lot of us blame Wes for our involvement, my story included. I was working as a contract diver for the Navy. I'd gotten out of the Navy. I was a Navy hardhat diver for a while, and I had gotten out of the Navy to become a contractor. And we had a little dive club on the base there in Andros Island where I had moved to. And they had these videotapes called Sea Fans Videos. They were VHS tape videos. And it was basically a video magazine. And at the end of one of those was a little article about multiple lighting techniques in underwater caves by some redneck named Wes Skiles, who I'd never heard of before. And I watched it, and I saw these amazing images using slave strobes and that type of thing, seeing how the depth of field was increased by using these different lights. And I was like, I'm a Navy diver. If this redneck can do this, I could do it. I knew about blue holes. This is where we got lobsters from. So, you know, I jumped in the cave with some of my strobes, and the first cave I ever had remembered, and immediately silted it out and, you know, had a very, you know, my respiration rate was a little elevated. Let's put it that way. And, but I got out and I said, oh, that's what he was talking about when he meant training. Right. And so that's my military stuff. Really, that's what saved me and said, okay, you got to learn how to do this right. Well, there wasn't any instructors. So I had heard of a guy who had gotten certified over in Florida, and he had this little book called Blueprint for Survival. And I said, dude, you got to let me read that book. He's like, nope. He's like,
geez, go it get only cost about $2. You could have got your own.
Yeah, well, we didn't have internet or anything back then. So it was, you know, harder to find out how to get that stuff. And it took me about 6 months to convince this guy to let me pry it out of his hands. And I read it, and I said, okay, all right, that all makes sense. And so then I just started going off and doing this stuff, using a guideline, using the thirds rules. I couldn't afford back-mounted doubles, you know, the manifolded doubles with the back BC and the back plate and all that. Because I was just a very poor young guy, and so, but I had read a book by Rob Palmer, into the Blue Holes, and I saw that they had made their equipment, these side mounted tanks. I said, "Oh, that's cool and cheap," and so I'll do that. And we had a canvas machine, a sewing machine, in our dive shop on the base, and so I started making my own harnesses, incorporating them into like Scuba Pro stab jackets. Type of thing. I mean, back in the late 80s, early 90s, that's when we all did that stuff. We just made our stuff. Lamar was really just kind of starting out at that point. And, basically just sort of taught myself and started doing, in Andros Island, everything's deep. And so you immediately get into technical diving. And these are way past any depth limitations that was placed on me by the Navy. So my Navy buddies thought I was insane and I was absolutely going to die. But yeah, I mean, that was pretty much how I got into it. That Blueprint for Survival saved my butt. And then I hooked up with Brad Pacell, who was just down the road working as a diving instructor for Small Hope Bay Lodge. Where he said, oh, I heard you were going into these blue holes. And of course, he thinks I'm going to kill myself too, because, I probably was. And he's like, come on out to the dock. I'll show you my gear. And Brad was this amazing guy. I haven't seen him for a little while, but he had done the same thing. But his fabrication place basically was a bench vise out at the end of the dock where they had their little scuba shack out there in Andros. And it was all stuff that had been hacksawed and hand stitched with an awl and, you know, all this other stuff. And he's like, look at my gear. And I was like, oh, cool. And I looked at it, and I looked at the stuff that I was looking at, Palmer's stuff, and I said, okay, very cool. And I went home, and I traded some lobsters for some milling machine work and stuff like that. And I had two sets of kit made, one for Brad, one for myself. And I took it out there. I thought the guy was going to cry. And then we just got to be good buddies, and we just started doing some really insane stuff, some amazing stuff in sort of the leavings of George Benjamin, who was the first cave explorer in the Bahamas. So we were picking up kind of where he had left off, but we were finding plenty of virgin stuff. It was, you couldn't keep line on the reels back in those days, especially as a side mounter.
Yeah. Do you remember what excited you about those blue holes in those early days?
I think first for me, it was reading about them and then going and seeing them for myself and realizing, wow, you're in the same place that, you know, your gurus, you know, these were guys that I was just like, oh my God, these are amazing people. They're true explorers. And here I was not only finding these places, but also extending lines or finding completely new places on myself. one of the ways I found a lot of places in Andros was I kind of put an APB out in town that if you found me a new cave that I didn't know about, it was a six pack of whatever you drank. If it was kids, it was soda. If it was, you know, if it was an adult, it was whatever beer they liked. Because we had access to American beer on the base. And or if it was a cave that had never been dived before, it was a whole case. And so everybody started learning my name in the area, and I was getting phone calls at work all the time. And my mommy does her washing in this hole in our backyard. Have you ever been in there? Oh, man, I'll come after work and check it out. So I learned a lot of cool places that way.
What a dream. What about you, Kenny? How did cave diving start for you? I hope you got some lessons.
Yeah, well, it was sort of a natural extension of, you know, anything that we could do in the water. And some of it was diving in golf courses for money when people ran their golf carts into the water. It was anything that could get me in the water, or keep me in the water, whether it was the ocean or a muddy hole. And then I met Hal Watts. I don't know if that name sounds familiar, but he was old time sort of deep air diver. And he had a place called Zuber Sink that he 40 fathom grotto. And he used to let us dive for free if I would drive his tanks down to Florida for getting hydroed and other types of shuttle runs for him, because it was about a 5 or 6 hour drive. So that kind of got me in that cave world. And then when I started working for Bob Friedman as a dive instructor, that's when I realized, sort of like Brian, that I was going in there sort of haphazardly. I mean, I knew always to run a line, but it was fairly deep, and I had a couple nitrogen narcosis experiences. When you're 19, at first they're fun, and then you realize maybe that's not the right. Maybe being dizzy at 80 meters is not a great idea. Eventually I started doing some stuff in the ocean in deep water with Tom Mount, and he was, was it Safe Cave Diving came before Sheck Exley's book. Is that right, Bri? You're older than me.
I think actually the NACD manual was the first one.
Yeah, I believe so. And that was Tom Mount. So started diving with Tom, and then found out about the formal training. And Bob Friedman said there's two people that should train you, and it's either Wes Skiles or Sheck Exley. And I ended up with Wes and that gang. But one of the things that I really love that Brian sort of touched on it, and I don't know if it's just every person as they start to get old, they get nostalgic, but there was this feeling of like innovation. Everything was new. Everything you had to come up with yourself. It wasn't searching the internet for parts. It was figure out how to do it. And I was just in awe. And it really, and it's the way, I mean, this podcast is about risk, right? And it really kind of showed me what I ended up studying later on more in academia. But as humans, we're really trial and error learners, right? And that's what it was. It was stay up all night, bend something, try a new harness, dive the next day, something great happens or something terrible happens. Oh, wow, I didn't even think that that would be dragging, or I didn't think that, wow, that kind of line doesn't work because it floats and gets tangled up. I mean, all those sorts of things. So it really felt like you were at the cutting edge. And the other thing that I think I appreciate now in retrospect is, you know, maybe we had cameras because we were shooting something for a film, and it literally was film. It wasn't doing it for social media. It wasn't doing it for sort of your own gratification. You just felt like you were going into a place that no one had been in. That alone was the satisfaction. And I mean, we still get those feelings, but I don't want to sound again like it's tainted, and there's plenty of innovation and trial and error still going on, but it's sort of a different small bands of people. It just wasn't very popularized, if you want to put it that way. So I found all those different things attractive, and I felt like it opened up a whole new physical world, but also a different way of thinking about risk and approaching risk.
Certainly the innovation of cave divers was one of the things that really attracted me to the community as well as the sport. And I was lucky enough to get into it early enough where we were still, seeing people with homemade lights, and I certainly made some myself. But I was on the cusp, I guess, later than you guys, so that I was lucky enough to to get into HID lights pretty early, and then of course the LED revolution, which has just changed everything, hasn't it? You know, you can take two LED backup lights and they'd be twice as reliable and right. 10 times the duration and 100 times the light output than the biggest, baddest old 12-volt car battery driven things yeah. that we used to tow around. So that alone has changed cave diving dramatically, I think, some of those technology innovations. But back in the day when everyone was making their own reels, their own lights, their own jackets, everything was very fun, and I just saw enough of it to appreciate, you know, what was going on, I guess. But you guys were there much earlier.
I mean, I think certainly the Bahamas, when Brian started and I first came out here, was Wild West. No regulations, no anything. Florida was the Wild West. No one, you know, no one told you what you could or couldn't do. You could show up anywhere and dive. You might have to do it at 2 a.m. if you're sneaking onto private property, but you're still, there weren't regulations per se and organizations that had a lot of rules. What about, because Australia seems like it's one of the most heavily regulated, managed cave diving communities out there. Was that a result, again, of sort of a lot of deaths and trial and error, or was it from the get-go a different sort of cultural model of risk?
I think early on in the 60s, it was very much the same as the States. It was, you know, if you want to go cave diving, you got to find some gear and build it yourself and find a hole and go swim in it, because no one was there to teach you or tell you how to do it in the correct and safe way. But in the early 70s, after a spate of about 11 deaths, the government pretty much threatened to shut the sport down before it had even really started. And so that's why the Cave Divers Association of Australia formed, to promise that they would raise the standard, provide not initially teaching, but at least assessment before people went into the sites, and to be a go-between for the landowners, to tell the landowners or try and reassure the landowners that we were presenting a united front of a non-product, that these people who we gave a card to would at least have a vague idea of what they were doing. And that was very effective. I was about to say something about the USA, which you touched on, and for me it's the best and the worst thing about America, and it's equally, for opposite reasons, the best and the worst thing about Australia, is that in America your right to do what you want seems to trump, pardon the pun, everything. it trumps all. You know, your right to make an independent assessment and do what you want is number one, which means that you have that enormous freedom by and large, but it also means you pay for it in terms of the number of fatalities that you see, because people do go diving without the appropriate training. The opposite is the case in Australia. We're so restricted and smothered in this nanny state. We can't do anything without forms in triplicate, but the upside is that we have an incredibly good safety record. So you can't have it both ways, I guess. And I do love going to countries like New Zealand, which are far less regulated, and we can kind of do whatever we want there, but we're conscientious and safety-minded divers. But they've got a really good balance there, actually. They're kind of maybe the middle.
Do you need to get permits for the piers?
No. I remember I first wrote to the Department of Conservation in New Zealand when I wanted to go and dive there, and you know, sent a very long letter describing exactly what our goals were, our background, our training, and all this stuff. And I just got a one-line answer saying, "Dear Dr. Harris, we have no policy on cave diving in New Zealand. Please enjoy your stay." I thought, oh, this is now my favourite country. And you know, their economy has a large amount of adventure tourism as part of it, and so they don't want to smother that by being over-regulated. I'm sure a lot of the Kiwis I talk to would say that it's getting over-regulated now, but I guess we all feel like that, and you guys probably do too. But, I think they've got a good balance between maybe what the US and Australia has.
Yeah, I think here in the Bahamas, we're still a bit in the Wild West aspect of it, because it's just logistically difficult to dive these places. And so there's only a few caves that are regulated in any way. Over in Grand Bahama, there's the Lucayan Caverns where Christina Zanotto dives, and then here the Crystal Caves of Abaco is the Queen's Commonwealth Canopy now, so it's a protected area. So other than that, unless it's on private property, it's sort of a free for all. And so many of our caves are in the ocean, So it's there's no regulations here in the Bahamas as far as what caves you can dive and what your qualifications might need to be. But I think if things change and we start having more of an inundation, which hasn't happened since I've been here, I've been doing this for 30 years. There's only two cave instructors in the entire country, and maybe a handful of actual certified cave divers.
I have to say, in Australia, you know, if I've got a friend who's got a farm and he's got a sinkhole on it, there's nothing in the law that says I can't go and dive it. And similarly, you don't need to have an open water ticket to go and dive in the ocean if someone lends you a tank. It's not illegal. But for good reasons, you know, the most popular cave diving sites have been regulated by landowners and these diving associations, which is a reasonable thing. I mean, we want to protect the caves as well, obviously.
And the U.S., I think, has moved more in the direction, certainly if it's on a state park or, you know, some kind or federal. And in large part, I think it's this schizophrenia where on the one side, there's this monomaniacal obsession with individual liberty, but it's a very litigious society. So, you know, people are really worried about getting sued and the whole liability. And that's come up a lot in the last probably decade. So that's, I think, changing why access is starting to get more and more restricted, or at least proven that you've had some kind of training.
I do remember when I visited Ginny Springs, and I was lucky to be under the wing of the famous Forrest Wilson, and he sort of introduced me, and I didn't have some of the certifications that were required to go there. I didn't have a scooter card, a DPV card. It wasn't really a thing I'd even heard of, to be honest. But I had plenty of time on scooters. And so because I was with Forrest, I was able to navigate through that bureaucracy, I guess. But, so in some ways, you know, there are places in the US, obviously, which are very highly regulated. But that, I guess, is the number one cave diving destination in the world, if not the States.
Right. And I think, but you know, that's the, even at Ginny, those places, it's the old adage, for your friends, anything, for your enemies, the rules.
I think as time goes on, I mean, Harry, you're a cave, are you a cave diving instructor for?
No, far too GDA? Selfish. Far too selfish to teach other
people. I'm with you on that one. But I don't want any more divers. What are you talking about?
So, but what I see is because there's been this transition from basically no training available or very little training available, and now everybody and their brother has become an instructor and everything. You have people like myself and Jill. I just watched a podcast with Jill last night, and she made the same comments that, you know, we have instructors such as myself who have our instructors for, say, DPV, but I never got my DPV card. You know, this was something that, you know, you had just done forever. And when you got up into your instructor levels, they just sort of waved the magic wand and you were an instructor. But I think that will phase out because now you have to go through these certifications.
And I'm a mixed mind of those certifications. Maybe it's my genetic, American genetic remnants. But, you know, I do think a lot of it is, and Brian can disagree because I'm not an instructor, but it does seem like you need a certification for everything, and that seems to be a good way to make money and keep certification agencies going as well. And I'm kind of not a big fan of that.
Hello, this is Giles English, the co-founder of Bremel Watch Company. We're proud to be supporting Dr. Harris with the show, an ambassador and a friend of the brand who symbolizes the core of Bremel with its Tested Beyond Endurance motto. As an engineering company, we specialize in the manufacturing of beautifully made mechanical aviation watches that are built to be worn in the boardroom or at Mount Everest. With our strong military links, we work with adventurers all over the world. Now, to learn more, please go to bremel.com and read about the likes of NIMS, who's just smashed the record for climbing the 14 highest peaks in under 7 months, and see the watch he's wearing. Well, thank you for listening and hope you enjoy the show.
Yeah, I mean, you see a lot of courses that have been divided up into different segments. I understand the need for training, absolutely. Some of the agencies have made it easier, you know, to accommodate a higher level of certification based on experience.
I'm sort of sitting on the fence a little bit with this one. I certainly see Kenny's point of view and agree with it by and large. But I think something's changed over the last 20 years where people who came to diving in the 70s and 80s often came from a background of being water people and, you know, grew up snorkeling and spearfishing and so on. And scuba was a natural progression for them. Nowadays, and which is fantastic, scuba is an experience that it's open to everyone, you know, regardless of age, ability, whatever, including disability, which is fabulous. And we've lost a lot of that club kind of mentality around the dive shop. So people come and they probably actually need those graduated courses to build up experience and to go out with other more senior or experienced people. Whereas when we did our open water tickets, it was kind of, you know, you already felt completely comfortable in and under the water, and most of us had already had a bit of a go at it anyway. It was just formalizing it. And then you fell under the mentors, you know, within the club or whatever. And certainly that's the way I approached my cave diving. I got my tickets along the way, but I tried to surround myself with very senior, experienced explorers who I wanted to be like, and they were the ones who kind of dragged me along for the ride. And it was because I admired what they were doing and the people so much that that's why I became so passionate about the sport. And you won't continue it if you just go chasing the cards and the tickets. And
yeah, I was the same way. I mean, I didn't get certified until I had to. Brad Pacell and I had gone to the first tech diving conference that Michael Meduno put together.
Aquacore.
When I was riding Aquacore, right? And so all of us divers from all over the place show up in Florida, and we go into this conference, and everybody's sort of just like sheepishly, you know, yeah, we do this and we do that. It's just a lot of stuff you didn't talk about back then because you get browbeat. It was kind of the same thing. All of a sudden, you know, you're meeting these people who are your mentors and stuff like that. But when I was there, they had started talking about Wakala 2. And I was like, I will do any, I will hose out your crapped in dry suit. I will do whatever it takes to be on that team. And Paul Heinerth, who now became my instructor afterwards, I had already been doing 300 foot deep air cave exploration dives and stuff at this point. But he's like, Brian, you're not even certified. They're not going to let you in the park, you know, and so you got to get certified. It's like, oh man. And so you're an instructor. I'll trade you a week of cave diving in the Bahamas for a course. And I didn't want to just, you know, okay, you're certified. So I need to know how you guys dive, because I only know what I've read in these books and what I've done with Brad. And so he came out, and the first time I had doubles on my back, and at first time I had actually shared air with a long hose. I mean, I didn't know how to do that kind of stuff before. And so that was, you know, it was a good training experience. But, you know, it was a certification by necessity for access rather than wanting to get the knowledge. Of course, you know, that's changed now. And that was mostly just because there were no instructors in my neighborhood.
Well, both of you cave divers for obvious reasons that you're passionate about the underwater, underground world, and you love just being in there and blowing bubbles underwater. But equally, both of you are very heavily involved in the science that is related to caves and cave diving. So I want to ask you both a little bit about the sort of work you do. And Kenny, you've been very quiet for the last 35 seconds. Why don't you tell me about
that? That's rare, huh?
I know. What's the science in caves for you? What's going on there?
I think that, you know, what's interesting about these caves is they're sort of one-stop shopping, right? And it's like I tell my students, if you can't be smart, be first. So you can get in there and there's a lot to get done on, you know, even really on a single dive, because you've got certainly have the geology and hydrogeology. So very involved I'm at the University of Miami and work with a geochemist there who analyze the cave formations, stalagmites, the ones that grow from the bottom of the speleothems. They look at the different oxygen isotope ratios and other ways to date them. And you can reconstruct past climate change going back very far and at very high resolution. So what was the climate like every year going back? I believe Brian has the oldest sample from Exumas around here. It's 350,000 years old or so. Is that right, Brian?
He was the latest, yeah.
36, yeah. So you've got that side of it. Then you've got the geological side. You've got the biological side, because there's, you know, these extremophile forms of life that can live in darkness and hydrogen sulfide and these, you know, alien environments. And they can teach us a lot, not only about what the earliest forms of life that evolved here on the Earth, which includes microbes, which are really interesting, but also what may be viable forms of life to look for in outer space. So you have astrobiologists who are interested in this stuff as well. And then there's obviously the water quality, water management side of things, which is very applied. Where is this water coming from? What are the recharge zones? You know, where should we zone cattle or industry that won't pollute our water and drinking source? How to monitor it? You often can't do it in a place like this from the surface. There aren't many surface expressions of the groundwater that makes up our drinking water, which is crazy, because if you look at the world, you know, if you look at the world's water supply and you take away the water that's locked up in ice, right, more than 95% of our water is out of sight, out of mind, invisible. And that's the other element that sort of connects, and maybe that's the environmental anthropologist in me. I really love getting involved with some of the film and photography projects, because it's bringing to life these areas that people have a really hard time envisioning. And as humans, we're not good at dealing with abstract concepts and acting on them. And it's really what started off as just a way to make some side money or get someone to pay for us to go to these amazing locations. Now, and I think Brian shares it, is really the outreach and education to me is, I'll be honest, more motivating than the science, because it's not going to be another paper that tells us, you know, oh, the climate is fragile and, you know, we need to do something about climate change. It's not going to be we're running out of water. We know that. It's going to be motivated. There's a motivation deficit, not an information deficit.
What about you, Brian? What do you pursue scientifically?
For me, as an explorer, it all started out about just wanting to lay that line, wanting to be first, wanting to be, have that placed all to yourself. That was just all encompassing. It just all consuming. And here in the Bahamas, because as an explorer, when all this new gear was coming out, you had access to everything. You couldn't not lay line here. It was almost impossible. And so after a while, you know, I wouldn't say it got boring, but it was the same thing all the time. And then I started seeing things, because I was spending so much time in there, that, well, why is that? What the heck is that? And why is it there? Why did it do what it just did? And so I started meeting some scientists and geologists, and they said, wow, you're seeing that. Could you get us some of that? And I was, yeah, of course. So I'd go in and collect something for them, and they get this big jaw drop, and you're like, you have no idea how important this thing is. And it's like, oh, that's pretty cool. But as time went on, I realized that these places were super special, because I was learning more about them through the sciences and everything, and that I needed to give back. I needed to try to protect these places. I needed to make people understand why they were so special, because now I'm learning all these different aspects. The only way I could do that, you can't go to a government and say, there's this tiny little thing that nobody else will ever see, and that's the reason you should protect this place. I needed the big picture. So I needed to hang out with all the scientists, all the ologies, I call them, and learn all the different aspects of these sciences, so that I had the big picture to take to the government and say, this is the reason why we shouldn't just throw stuff in these holes. This is the reason why we shouldn't just bulldoze this thing in. And it's not just because of one little critter. It's because this is your culture. This is your water supply. These are amazing ecosystems that haven't changed. You know, we've all heard about evolution and the evolution of animals, but these animals have been in a static environment, so they haven't evolved. And so that's really amazing to me. So trying to take all that information to the government with my conservation proposals, and saying, here you go, this is why. And being able to do that through my connections with the scientific communities and helping contribute are pretty cool. And that's the one last aspect of it is as an uneducated person, I barely graduated high school. I was spent too much time surfing and diving and then joined the military. But to be able to contribute to science as a basically a non-academic, to me, is pretty amazing. And to learn this outside of a college atmosphere was very amazing.
Yeah, I wanted to really emphasize what Brian just said for anyone listening. It does not take an academic degree to make major finds, major advances in, you know, what's really critical issues, critical basic knowledge issues of finding new things. I mean, it's really about, I'm amazed still every time I dive with Brian, because we swim by something and he sees some tiny creature, and he's older than I am. His eyes are just as bad. And, you know, he's able to just the pattern recognition and his ability, you know, again, from just thousands and thousands of hours underwater. And, it doesn't have to be underwater for other listeners, whether it's in a forest, whether it's in an urban ecology environment. I mean, you can make some real contributions by just repetitive visits and awareness. And I think that notion of citizen science is really underutilized. And I tell a lot of kids, don't go to school, follow your passion. And if it leads you to having to go back to school, and that's what happened with me. I was not motivated in school either. It wasn't until I could make a link to the ocean and aquatic things that I cared about that I went back to school. So, you know, follow your passion. It sounds cliche, but it's really true. You can end up like Brian also, shoving yourself into small, muddy holes for years on end, living on a warehouse with your dog and salty dive gear that occasionally gets flooded by hurricanes. And then your freeloading friends come over like me and borrow dive gear. So, you know, something to strive for.
Along the lines of what Kenny said with, you know, when he's talking to younger people and everything, and that's one of the main things I try to drive home when we give talks at schools, local schools here, is that, you know, we're explorers. All of us here on the screen are you know, world-class explorers. And the thing is we haven't done it all. There's still stuff out there. And so for these kids who are watching us and looking at us saying, oh, that's cool, they got to be the first, but what about me? It is not all done by any means. Just the cave that I dive every day is, you know, Kenny and I have been mapping this thing. We're up to almost 12 miles of cave passages. I'll be long dead and gone before this cave is finished. So there is definitely stuff out there, you know, for the next generation, whether it's the technology that helps them along or just the drive to go and do it. Like, you know, I look at what you do, Harry, at the Pearson Surgeons, and there is nothing short of just absolute drive to get you to where you guys have been out there.
Well, there's a screw loose.
But I want to instill that in young people and say it's not about sitting behind the TV screen and the Xbox or the computer screen. It's about getting out there. And this has always been my motto, whatever it takes. If you see interviews with me from back in the 90s, I always say, whatever it takes, I do whatever it takes to get to that place, to go see that place, whatever it takes. If I have to take out a loan, I did that for Wakulla. You know, I took a sabbatical from my job, took out a loan so I could pay my bills, and then went for 3 months. So whatever it takes to go out and do that, if you have that drive, you're going to get to places like the bottom of the Pierce, to the back of Dan's Cave, the bottom of Dean's Blue Hole, to the bottom of into Cheve or Huadla. You know, places like that. And it's all about the drive.
You're listening to Real Risk, the adventure podcast with Richard Harris.
I'm so glad to hear you guys, make these comments, especially, you know, for the younger people listening, because it is so true. And we all always feel that, oh, the last generation had it so good. There was so much of whatever, you know. And I think maybe for mountain climbers, those guys, you know, they're in the wrong sport because a lot of those mountains are done. So they got to change sports now. But apart from mountain climbers, I think, you know, the rest of us have still got it pretty good. You can still do it, walk up the hill backwards without oxygen, or, you know, with your eyes closed, right, or something. But
I think you do have to differentiate exploration from adventure. And I do see exploration as having a purpose that serves a greater good versus just getting to the top of something, like you said, in some other route that we already know that's there. We can see by drone or satellite what's already there. But I think there's viable reasons to go back to places we've gone to 100 times now with new technologies. So environmental DNA and some really interesting new techniques, new types of sensors that can help us monitor weather, environmental conditions. I was just involved with an expedition to Everest, and it was, again, you know, look, there's long lines going to Everest, but now it's putting up a new type of weather station that can help understand changes in the jet stream and some other, you know, issues that can help understand the monsoon that can then help plan better for crops and et cetera. So, I mean, I think there's a lot to go back to, and it's, I'm all for getting to the deepest, the furthest, and those kind of places. But I think there'll be people coming back to the entrance of, you know, the caves here in the Bahamas for a long time and learning a lot of stuff with all the new techniques out there. So it's really exciting. And as you said, Harry, man, for the young kids out there, there's just so many opportunities.
Yeah. You can always be the first person to put a weather station on Everest without oxygen. That'd be amazing.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's what, that'll be Kenny. But I would have said all that.
You can do it naked too.
Oh God.
have you seen that guy, Wim Hof? Oh, look at it. Really interesting. I did the technique. It's this sort of breathing meditation exercise technique for withstanding the cold. And I'm the biggest wimp ever with cold. And it worked enough. I went swimming in New York in December just to see if it would work after trying it for 6 weeks. It worked.
Thank you, Kenny. I'll be taking that on. And
well, for the Pierce resurgence, that's my real goal. Is can I go with you guys? Not go diving, just so can I bathe in it while you're
diving?
Can
sit in the entrance. You'll love that. Yeah, yeah.
That sounds good to me.
Well, everything you said is true, but I still wouldn't downplay the personal, quest to do things that have been done before by other people. I think, you know, for some people to climb Everest as a personal challenge or to circumnavigate the world in a small boat or all these things, I think it's a very important thing for us as humans to do things that challenge us, even if it's not to go further or set a record or any of those things. And, to bring science and technology to bear to learn more about a place is one good reason, but just to do it for yourself is obviously another. And that's probably why we all got into these type of activities at the end of the day.
Yeah. I just hope that it keeps going. I hope that our society keeps the drive.
Yeah. And I don't disagree with I actually strongly agree that I'm all for people pushing their own personal limits, whatever they may be, for those reasons. I guess where maybe I get a little defensive or irked is when the adventure side and the social media, the self-aggrandizing, all that sort of takes away from what the value of funding real exploration. And when I say real, I mean it for, you know, something that's bringing back something for the larger public good in terms of base of knowledge or helping with policy making or resource management, whatever. But and increasingly to get the science money, you also have to be self-promotional, which is, I find that, you know, for older people, especially if you're ugly and bald like me, it's getting difficult. Thank God this is a radio show, right? Or I'd never get funded again.
Well, I was going to say it's a sad reality of life that you can't really do one without the other anymore. And if you want to get funding for something that's expensive but very special, that usually means that it goes hand in hand with a blogging or social media account or, you know, that kind of activity. But you just need a marketing manager, Kenny, to make you look good and to let you get on with the business at hand, so you don't have to worry about that stuff.
It really has gone that direction. I mean, you know, if you look at the Explorers Club, you know, now, I mean, there's the whole sort of commercial side of that.
Groups like National Geographic, which we work, you know, very closely with, and I still have the utmost of respect. It's changed in my short lifetime dramatically, you know, being bought by 20th Century Fox, then Disney, these increasingly large corporations, even though there's a small nonprofit, they're to a certain degree beholden to these larger groups. And it you know, it does then change the incentives for what gets funded and how you pitch things to them, which, you know, I guess that's the way it goes, as Harry said.
Well, let's swing back a little bit to some of the excitement of pure exploration and the sport side of what we're doing. You may know that I had Bill Stone on the podcast during the last series, and you know, in terms of major exploration projects, it's hard to think of a guy who does things on a grander scale with more of an engineering kind of slant to what he does. He's an obsessive planner and executor of these enormous undertakings. And you've both been involved at different times in his projects. Brian, in particular, with Wakulla, and I'm not sure whether you're on that one, Kenny, but Kenny, you were certainly involved in the major exploration in the Huatla system down through the sumps over 1,000 meters underground. I just think those expeditions, those two particular projects, hold so much in my imagination. You know, if I could have been involved on any project ever, it would have been one of those two. Maybe not the one you went on, Kenny, down to the bottom of the Huatla, because you know, vertically down ropes down to the dive site requires a certain agility and fitness, which I probably have never held, but you clearly have and probably still do hold. I think, Brian, you feel the same way about dry caving to some extent as I do.
That little button on the BC is my friend.
Because it just looks like a lot of hard work down there, Kenny.
Tell us. Well, you could get down there easily.
Oh, I'm all right on the down.
It's the coming up part that's a hassle.
Tell us a bit about that trip.
Yeah, I mean, just to comment on Bill Stone, I think he's the quintessential modern day explorer in the sense that he is so focused and willing to sacrifice, you know, anything. And I love working with him because he leaves it up to you how much you want to push. And as long as you're honest with him about your limitations, he will not ever question you on that. But he'll also won't question you if you say, you know, am I allowed to cuss on this thing, on this podcast? You can, you know.
Oh, yeah, go.
Oh yeah, fuck it, fuck it, Bill. I'm gonna go for it, you know. And he won't get in your way. And he's really amazing. I mean, to bring the mindset, he's also a physically just amazing workhorse, and he has the technological, you know, scientific brain. And I mean, talk about Wattla, but we're still working with him. We've been working in the Channel Islands with his group in the sea caves there, and they're just as active and pushing the edge of pushing technologies into difficult areas. And always with this, I didn't realize it because I was a 26-year-old, you know, naive, just wanted to explore. That was it when I went to Wattla in Mexico. But, you know, to me, this was the deepest cave in the world and this amazing opportunity for exploration. To Bill, this is just part of a small long-term plan to test, to use these earthly difficult places as analogs for going to harsh, you know, to Mars and Europa and these other outer space. I mean, it was his mind was operating on such a different long-term level, which I'm sure you got that out of your podcast. But yeah, Wattla was the greatest time of my life, where it's just, you know, cutting edge technology, caving in what was the deepest known cave at the time. And with someone who, you know, we didn't even have to talk. We could answer each other's sentences. Ian Rowland, the British explorer, and we were the two youngest on the expedition and best of buddies. And we found ourselves at the deepest point in the cave, and it was our turn to push it. And we were very successful and found our way through the sump. And then it went from the highest point in my life where I'd never had something happen to the absolute lowest, where he didn't come back from. I found the way through the sump. He did the next dive. He was a much better dry caver. So he went, and, you know, to make a long story short, it was then all of a sudden the realities of exploration just hit me in the face when your friend doesn't come back. He left with a teddy bear on his helmet, you know, one of his two young kids. So it was, you know, what was just fun, crazy, sure, tiring, painful, exhausting, some scary, but, you know, but exhilarating, all of a sudden went to the lowest of lows. And you realize you're at the bottom of the earth and you're the next 6 days spending with your friend's, you know, dead body, bringing it up to the surface. You're never the same after that. I mean, just to end on a slightly positive note, you know, I've kept in touch with his family. His son, who's now Connor Rowe, is now heavily involved with the British stunt diving community. He's been back to Wattla and came and stayed with my family and my two little kids for a month. We cruised all around North Florida, dove the classic sites. He met his dad's friends. So it's amazing, right? 24 years later, how things can come full circle. And it was sort of almost like cathartic, therapeutic, that life goes on, which in the same with Wes's son, who I'm still very close with, was, you know, best man in his wedding. And it makes me realize that if something happens to me in a cave, that life does go on, and your family and friends, you know, you leave something in them, but it's still in the balance. It makes it worth the risk. I don't know if that was a long digression, but.
No, that's nice. And yeah, I got to meet Connor, of course, and
dive. Oh, right, with in him Thailand. And, that's
yeah,
right.
And as you say, a delightful guy and very extraordinarily competent young man in a cave, very, very capable guy.
Looks just like his dad and has the same sense of humor.
Is that right?
It was amazing.
Yeah. When you lost your friend in the cave there, did that change your attitude to caving and diving for a period of time or forever?
It definitely changed my attitude towards it. And it doesn't, I think, you know, probably like a lot of 26-year-old, especially males, well, certainly in the moment you have to go, and you know this, and Brian certainly knows this, in any type of emergency, you have to go sort of shut off all those, your affective, emotional part of your system, just to survive getting out, you know, and carrying through the execution. And it didn't hit me, or I think it was probably much later that it started to really hit home. And we try to rationalize it by analyzing the accident itself and telling yourself why this wouldn't happen to you again. And this came after, the expedition actually came after a spate of near misses I had. Right before the expedition, I was in Jamaica working on a crack cocaine distribution study in a very rough urban area, and had a lot of very close calls in that work, and had a little bit of PTSD from that, just from the seeing what went on in terms of domestic violence, rape, and all sorts of horrific things that living there. And then I got to Wattla, and then I went right after that to an expedition in the Pacific atolls with my best friend doing coring for climate reconstruction, and got stuck there. Was supposed to be 2 weeks, was 8 weeks. And I just started feeling like the deck was stacked against me. And had my friend got gangrene in his leg on that trip. There's just one thing after another. And at some point, I remember coming back and I'm like, I want a white picket fence, a dog named Spot, you know, and like a 9-to-5 desk job. But that sort of faded away. But I think those PTSD aspects would then surface in ways, it's only fairly recently that I'm realizing it and sort of sorting that out. So.
Do you think it's made you a safer caver overall?
I think so. I think it's made me better at rationalizing what I do, or at least the acceptance of it and acceptance of what it means, you know, how it can affect other people's lives as well. But I think, yes, overall safer. Certainly this idea of just go for it, you know, which is how I started when I first met Bill Stone, you know, and he handed me the rebreather, no manual, no anything. I just put it on and jumped in a cave by myself. And I realized how stupid that is now. So I'm much more systematic, meticulous. I don't mind calling a dive. I don't even mind saying, hey, I'm not even doing this dive. I'm not going to the Pierce Resurgence, you know, no way. So
Yeah, I think there's a line in a song that goes, life gets more precious when there's less of it to waste. So the older we get, I think, is we're a little more apt to say, okay, well, I don't have to do that today.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. That's a good one.
And I'm sure you'll both agree that the divers and, you know, the cave divers I respect the most are the people I have seen say, you know what, not for me today, you guys carry on. I've certainly seen you do that, Brian, when, you know, your camera's not working and something else is not working, you go, just, nah, not today, can't be bothered.
Yeah, usually with a bunch of profanities laced with.
Oh, there was a few profanities, but.
And some don't forget the flying objects.
Not so much flying objects anymore. I think I've grown out of that, but I'm an old Navy guy. The expletives are not going to go away.
Yeah. So what are you boys doing this week? You've obviously gone over there for a bit of fun to hide from the virus in Florida, Kenny. What's going on?
It's been my boat over here that I brought a bunch of, you know, all the equipment on. So then a hurricane came, which then COVID lockdown. So we're sort of in a bit of a hiatus in terms of even legally being able to go diving. But we were, prior to the lockdown, as Brian mentioned, there's miles of cave that, you know, but a lot of it needs to be either surveyed or resurveyed. One of the original explorers, Fred Davis, didn't get to survey a lot of what he explored, or it's time to update it. We're using Sebastian Keister's NEMO device, which really helps quickly automate the survey process. So it's just going, Brian, I don't know, in the last 3 or 4 dives, I don't know how many thousands of.
Yeah, just under 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
3,000 meters.
So trying to really nail some of the big passageways and get a good map, which can then help with identifying, being more efficient, looking for leads.
Well, I probably should have said at the start of the show that Brian Kocook from Bahamas Underground is the custodian, if you like, of arguably, in fact, there's not really an argument, is there, that these are the most spectacular and highly decorated and most scientifically important flooded caves in the world, full of all sorts of interesting geological and biological phenomenon and lots of amazing fossils and all the stuff that blokes like Kenny would love to come and tinker with And Kenny himself lives has a house in an amazing little enclave with fabulous food and cold beer, and he looks out over the ocean, eyeing off his favourite surf break. So, anyone out there feeling at all sorry for either of these blokes should immediately push that thought aside, because they're living in paradise. Look, you guys, I can't thank you enough. It's been a fantastic chat, and I could spend at least another 2 hours doing it, but I know you've got very important work to get on with today, to go and put your tanks on and go and lay some more line or map some more line. So it's been a real treat to catch you both in the same spot, and it's been really enjoyable. So I hope you have a great day under the water.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, it was awesome talking with you.
Looking forward to the next time we're in the water together.
Cheers, bye-bye. Guys. All right, bye. Thank you. That's it for this episode of Real Risk. If you're a risk taker or know someone who'd be good for the show, please send me an email on admin@speleopix.com.au. I'd love to hear from you. Let me know what you think of the podcast. Subscribe, give me a rating, but most importantly, join me for the next one. We'll see you again on Real Risk.